From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. On this week's podcast, how the new gateway drug is closer than you think.
You can honestly find it anywhere. Most people even find it in their own medicine cabinet.
Prescription painkillers and the heroin epidemic. And 100 years ago in Los Angeles, opening a Watergate changed everything.
We would not have Los Angeles as we know it. The state of California would be different. You know, arguably, the world would be different without the LA Aqueduct.
Also this week, the dangers of bird watching while black.
You're a black man sneaking around in the nether regions of a suburban park at dusk with a spotting scope.
And comedian Rob Delaney talks about how he was able to pull out of a tailspin and stay funny.
I lived my life in a way where I could have died at any moment, which is, yes, sure, that's sad. But once I realized I could kill other people, that's when I said, okay, I'm going to stop.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. In a moment, we'll have more on the shooting at LAX. First, meet John Nygren. He's a fourth-generation Wisconsinite from the small town of Marinette.
It's a middle to lower middle-class manufacturing community. We actually build ships as well as paper mills and other heavy manufacturing. Typical, you know, a northern Wisconsin community.
Nygren grew up there on the border with Michigan. He owned a restaurant, started a family, and eventually a career in politics. He's a Republican, and he represents Marinette in the state assembly. Several years ago, Nygren says, his teenage daughter Cassie started having trouble.
She would not come home in the evenings at times. She was not going to school. There were incremental steps along the way where we saw there were problems.
Nygren was unprepared for what came next. Cassie had started using the prescription painkiller OxyContin. She was addicted. Eventually, Cassie moved on to other drugs. She met her father for dinner at a pizza place in town and broke the news.
I remember her telling me that she was addicted to heroin. I was almost literally sick to my stomach. You know, my perception of heroin was a big city problem. Maybe rock stars and, you know, people of that type used heroin, but not your very intelligent 18-year-old pretty girl who had a bright future ahead of her.
All around the country, communities like Marinette and families like the Nygrens have witnessed a spike in heroin abuse. It's sending people to emergency rooms, ripping apart families, and destroying thousands of lives. That's our cover story today, America's new heroin crisis.
I got a frantic call from her mom one day, and she had gone home to close windows because of an upcoming storm, and she found her laying on the bathroom floor, struggling to breathe. I raced over there. She still had a needle in her arm, and you were literally watching your daughter die before you.
Cassie Nygren had overdosed on heroin. The paramedics arrived in time to save her life, but she continued to struggle with addiction. She's been in and out of treatment and is currently serving time in county jail. According to numbers from the federal government, the number of people using heroin has grown significantly, by more than 60% over the last 10 years. Part of what's so surprising about Cassie Nygren's story and others is the location.
From 1965 to 1990, the only people that used heroin were inner city poor kids. It had nothing to do with ethnicity. It had to do with poverty. Those are the only people that use heroin.
That's Bob Stuttman. He worked for the Drug Enforcement Administration for more than 25 years and retired in the early 1990s as head of the New York division. Stuttman says the nature of drug use has drastically changed in the U.S. The suburbs and rural areas are getting hit especially hard. He says a lot of it has to do with the rise in abuse of prescription painkillers, known as opioids.
All of these people who are today going to heroin did not start with heroin. Most of them started with opioids like OxyContin. They used those for a year, two, three, where they got them very cheaply or for free from medicine chests. And then when they had to buy them on the street, they found out that heroin is about half the price. And that's, in my opinion, the reason we are seeing the new heroin epidemic in the United States.
According to federal data, 80% of people who used heroin in the past year had previously abused these prescription painkillers. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is the chief medical officer for a drug treatment network called Phoenix House and the president of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. He says these drugs contain very similar ingredients.
The term opioid includes drugs which are derived from opium, and they include medications that are commonly prescribed, like morphine or oxycodone or hydrocodone, which is the active ingredient in Vicodin, and they also include heroin. And what all of these drugs have in common is a very similar molecule, and when they attach to the brain's opiate receptor, they all cause a very similar effect.
There's a good chance you've been prescribed an opioid painkiller at some point, for dental work or broken bones or after surgery. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the amount of prescription painkillers sold to pharmacies, hospitals, and doctor's offices quadrupled between 1999 and 2010. Experts agree it was largely a well-meaning attempt to manage people's pain. But Dr. Kolodny says the United States is completely alone in this trend.
The United States has about 4% of the world's population, and we're consuming more than 80% of the world's oxycodone supply. We're also consuming more than 99% of the world's hydrocodone.
In many cases, the prescriptions are entirely legitimate. Dr. Eleanor McCants-Katz is an addiction expert with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration.
Opioid medications are effective pain relievers and used by the majority of people for that purpose. Individuals do not become addicted to these medications when used as clinically prescribed. But there are people who have vulnerability to addiction.
Many people don't get the drugs from a doctor, but from a medicine cabinet, a friend, or a dealer. The CDC now calls prescription painkiller abuse a growing, deadly epidemic. Again, Dr. Kolodny.
With the increase in prescribing, what we've seen is that it's led to parallel increases in rates of addiction and increases in rates of drug overdose deaths. And it's gotten so bad that the CDC is now telling us there are more people in the United States dying each year from drug overdoses than car crashes.
What is it about opioids that makes them so addictive?
Not only do opioids produce a euphoria, but when you get used to taking them on a regular basis, in order to get that euphoria, you need to continue taking higher and higher doses. And once your body is used to the drug, without the drug, you begin to feel very sick. You feel this flu-like illness and literally feel sometimes like they're going to die. It's like having a panic attack. So you have both a positive reinforcement, the effect when you take the drug, but also a very strong negative reinforcer, which is that you'll feel very sick when you don't have the drug. And those two together make opioids extremely addictive.
Both the government and physicians are working to stop the abuse of prescription painkillers. Just last week, the FDA recommended putting new restrictions on hydrocodone, the active ingredient in Vicodin. That has concerned some patient and physicians groups. They worry that people in pain will lose access to legitimate medications. Dr. Kolodny believes the restrictions are necessary and will prevent new people from developing addiction.
But we have millions of people in this country who have the disease already. And if they don't have access to legal sources, many of them will turn to the black market. And if they can't find black market pills, they'll buy heroin on the black market. And what this tells us is that we have to make sure that the millions of people who have this disease have access to effective treatment.
Dr. McCants-Katz says that opioid addiction is a chronic illness, but fortunately, very treatable.
As people get treatment, and that treatment includes medication and psychosocial treatments, they do recover.
We visited one young woman who is on the other end of that treatment. Prini Ibrahimi is 18 years old, from Glendale, California.
I have my daily problems like everybody, but nothing I can't handle compared to what it was like before.
Ibrahimi spoke to us from her family's apartment, her mother looking on. She told us she had struggled in school with attention deficit disorder. Around the time she was 13 or 14, Ibrahimi says she fell in with the wrong crowd. First, there was marijuana. Then there were the prescription painkillers, which were so easy to find.
You can honestly find it anywhere, in school, at home. Most people even find it in their own medicine cabinet.
Then there was methamphetamine, and one day she tried smoking heroin.
After that day, I just fell in love with the feeling and the numbing pain. And I just kept doing it and doing it and doing it, and it just ate away at my life.
How often were you using?
Every day, every hour.
And how long did that go on?
For about a year and a half.
Eventually, Ibrahimi bottomed out. She had stopped using heroin on her own, but that brought on withdrawal. She stole her father's car to meet a dealer and nearly ran over her father driving away. When she got home, her family confronted her.
And everybody was just trying to talk to me, and I was just going crazy because I didn't want to talk. I just wanted to go be alone and do it. My brother came and he helped me, and he was like, "What's wrong?" He's like, "Are you high right now?" I'm like, "Oh, no, I'm not. I'm like, I need it." And they start talking. They're like, "We don't know what else to do. You need to stop." It was just too much pain for my family, too much for myself. The high itself, that numbing pain, was just not worth it anymore to put my family and myself through. And I just wanted to stop.
Ibrahimi's parents had her placed in juvenile detention and a judge-mandated residential drug treatment at Phoenix House. She stayed there for 5 months. It has been a long road, one that has clearly taken a toll on her family. But Ibrahimi has been clean and sober for almost 3 years. She has a job now and plans to start college in the spring.
These years sober have been the best years of my life. I've gained so much trust back, and it's a feeling like no other, honestly, going through all that and being here right now, like a place you never thought you'd be. It's honestly amazing. I can say I'm proud of myself.
In Wisconsin, Representative John Nygren is working to change things. As he told us, when his daughter Cassie overdosed, she was not alone in that bathroom, but her friends left her to die, probably because they were afraid of the authorities getting involved. Nygren has introduced legislation to give people legal protection when calling 911 about an overdose. It's part of a package of bills to cope with the opioid crisis in his state. Wisconsin is not alone. Around the country, states are studying reform and passing laws. Communities are now coming to terms with a new American epidemic. This is NPR News. Sir Terry Pratchett is one of Britain's best-selling authors, second only to J.K. Rowling. His science fiction series, Discworld, has sold millions of copies worldwide. And Pratchett is incredibly prolific, publishing an average of 2 books a year. But in 2007, Terry Pratchett announced that he had been diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's. As a result, Pratchett can no longer read. Yet he continues to write. This week, Pratchett is publishing a re-edited version of his first novel, The Carpet People, which he wrote when he was just 17 years old. It's a book for young readers about a whole world of tiny people living deep in the hairs of a carpet. I sat down with Pratchett earlier this fall and asked him where he got the idea for The Carpet People.
One day I had a friend with me and we were just hanging out, and he was sort of walking around the room, and I said, don't keep doing that, you'll upset the carpet people. Heaven knows why I said it, but a little bit later I wondered whether it would be possible to do a fantasy of very, very small people who live in the very depths of the carpet.
And I want to talk about the story of the book. These main characters, they're these tiny people that live in the carpet. Let's hear an excerpt, the opening of the story.
They called themselves the Munrungs, and it meant the people, or the true human beings. It's what most people call themselves to begin with. Then, one day, the tribe meets some other people, and it gives them a name like the other people, or, if it's not been a good day, the enemy. If only they'd think up a name like some more true human beings, it'd save a lot of trouble later on.
These tiny people, they're not really very different from us, are they?
If they were too different from us, we can't sympathize with them in any way, I should imagine. It's very straightforward. They're very small. They're in a carpet, and that's it. But they don't know they're in a carpet. To them, it's like this great big forest. I was younger in those days.
Well, you wrote it when you were 17, and is it safe to say that as a writer, you're rather critical of that 17-year-old's work now?
Well, yes. But there's always going to be a difficulty here. An author writes a book, and that's the book at that point. And if the author writes the book again, then somehow something has gone wrong, if you see what I mean. And really, it was just a children's book. I had a great deal of fun writing it, and then more or less I forgot it.
There is something also about the story and about your writing is that while these are fantastic and kind of fantasy worlds, they don't resort to as much kind of magic or mysticism, if you know what I mean.
Well, if we're getting down and dirty, you can make magic very quickly just by changing one single thing in the world. If you change the speed of light, for example, things would be different. If you took the moon away, things would be different.
So there would still be natural laws, laws of physics, but everything would be changed.
Well, you, as the writer, you just decided what to change.
For American listeners who don't know, I want to talk a little bit about your memory, because it's part of the story. People in the UK are probably more aware of how when you're only 59 years old, you were diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and it's a peculiar form of the disease. It affects your vision especially.
Well, yes. In fact, what I have is called PCA. It's a kind of Alzheimer's. For example, I can't read a book. When you read, I'm sure, you don't realise that your eyes are going backwards and forwards and to this place and that place. Mine don't do that.
How do you use technology to help you still create the way that you have been for the last several years?
Are you familiar with Dragon Dictate?
Yes. This is an automatic dictation software.
I tried using it, and I went onto the web and said, this is pretty good, but I think it could be better. And a couple of guys here in England contacted me and said, we've designed something to make Dragon Dictate better to use. It's called Talking Point, and I was using it only yesterday.
Do you feel like your voice has changed at all in the last several years?
Well, the style comes from the computer, in a sense. I give it the words, I watch them come down, and if they seem to me to be the right words there, I think I'm on a winner. It really isn't a problem. I'm a bit of a techie anyway, so talking to the computer is no big deal. Sooner or later, everybody talks to their computers. They say, you bastard.
So how long do you think you'll be able to keep on like this, to keep writing?
Well, I think it's a race between what you might call the death that comes to everybody and to the PCA. If that catches me before that happens, then, well, I've gone, haven't I? Siren voices tell me, you don't have to keep going on. And then you think, well, I'm a writer. If I do, what do I do? I like being a writer. The book I'm writing now is going to be a good one, I believe. And if it gets really bad, I'll get the little men to go into the flying saucer and take me away from it all.
Well, I'm wondering if you're hinting at something you've spoken about before, which is the issue of assisted suicide. I know you've been very vocal about. Is that what you're getting at?
Yes.
Can I ask you, I understand that you have the music picked out that you want to listen to when you take the final exit.
Yes. Thomas Tallis. Spem in Allium.
And this is a glorious piece of vocal music, and I was wondering if you could talk about why you want that piece.
It's kind of a strange thing. My family had no religion. It still doesn't. My parents reckoned that Jesus was a decent man and ought to be listened to. But they didn't like the local clergyman, so I have no God. I'm quite happy about it, really.
But this piece of religious music speaks to you somehow?
Yes, because it's, well, music is eternal, one might say. At Spem in Allium, the first time I heard it, my wife was playing it in the kitchen. And actually, I fell down on my knees just because of the magic. I didn't know what it was about. But Thomas Tallis, good grief, what had he written?
Terry Pratchett is the legendary science fiction writer. He spoke to us from London. Terry Pratchett, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. It's November, and the nights are getting longer. For some of us, depressingly so. But the Norwegian town of Rjukan has it really bad. For almost half the year, it is entirely in shadows. Mountains that surround the town kill the little bit of direct sunlight they get in the winter. But this week, things got brighter in Rjukan, with the installation of a system of mirrors to shine some sunlight on the town. Corinne lives there, and she joins me now. Corinne, thanks for being with us.
Yes, my pleasure.
First off, am I pronouncing the name of the town correctly, Rjukan?
Almost. It's Rjukan.
Rjukan.
Yeah.
So just how dark is it, before the mirrors were installed? How dark is it?
It's not like in northern Norway, like it's dark all day. But of course, we notice it when the sun is shining and we see the sky is blue. Then we see that down in the valley, it's darker. It's like on a cloudy day.
And how many months of the year is it that you have that kind of darkness?
It's about 6 months a year, from late September till in the middle of March.
Wow. Do people get sad during that time?
It is colder, it is darker, but that's how it is in Norway anyway.
So what was it like when they installed the mirrors this week?
It was wonderful. We had sun today as well, and people have been sitting there and standing there and taking pictures of each other, and the town square was totally full. We are not that big town, so I think almost all people in the town was on the town square.
With the giant mirrors, is it like having another sun up there on the hill? What does it look like?
Yeah, the mirrors are like squares, so it doesn't look like sun. But when the sun is shining on the mirrors, it's a very sharp lightning. So it's reflecting the sunlight down to the square.
How big is the patch of sunlight? Is there enough for everybody?
Not at one time. It's about 600 square meters. So it's not very big, but it's enough when we are sharing.
Now, I know that far north, you also get the very long daytimes in the summertime. So does that mean you get double sunlight in the summertime as well?
We don't know, but we have to check it out when the summer is coming, because maybe this will be too warm.
Do you think it's going to change life dramatically for people in the town?
People are already happier. We have got so much feedback from the opening day. I don't think it will change dramatically, but I think it will change people's lives, yes.
Corinne, thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That's Corinne She works for the tourism office in... I'm sorry, can you say the name of the town again?
Rjukan.
I'll leave that to you. Thank you again.
Thank you. Bye. And there'll be sun all over our bodies, and
sun. I love birds, but honestly, I'm not much of an outdoorsman. So I often engage in city birding, which can be surprisingly rewarding. In Manhattan, I used to watch peregrine falcons hunting pigeons between skyscrapers. There's a drawback, though. Walking around apartment buildings with binoculars in a big city, people are more likely to think you're a pervert than a birder. Imagine if some awkwardness and suspicion followed you everywhere you went birding, and you might have an idea what it's like to be an African-American birder. Drew Lanham is an avid birder and professor of wildlife ecology at Clemson University. He has an essay in the current issue of Orion magazine called 9 Rules for the Black Birdwatcher.
Nocturnal birding is a no-no. Yeah, so you're chasing that once-in-a-lifetime rare owl from Outer Mongolia that's blowing up your Twitter alert. You're a black man sneaking around in the nether regions of a suburban park at dusk with a spotting scope. Guess what? You're going to have some prolonged conversations with the authorities, even if you look like Forrest Whitaker. Especially if you look like Forrest Whitaker.
So, you mentioned yourself that black birders, to use your terminology, you're an endangered species. I think you said that birding is one of the whitest things that you can do. Why is that, do you think?
I grew up in Edgefield, South Carolina, kind of in the boondocks. And so, you know, birds were just a natural part of my life. And as I began to watch birds from the second grade onward, you know, I didn't run into anyone who looked like me who liked birds. You know, it just became clear that it was an overwhelmingly white hobby, and I think the data from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service bears that out.
Hmm. One of your rules, you suggest that black birders have an affinity with black birds. Could you break that down?
You know, I'll read that if I can.
Yeah.
Black birds, any black birds, are your birds. Crows and their kin are among the smartest things with feathers and wings. They're largely ignored because of their ubiquity and often persecuted because of stereotype and misunderstanding. Sounds like profiling to me.
I always thought crows got a bad rap.
And they do, Arun. They get a really bad rap, you know. Culturally, they've been seen as kind of tricksters and thieves, and they see them in that way, but they are super smart birds. The research bears that out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, complex language and the ability to identify faces on humans. And, you know, going forward and thinking about those blackbirds and how they are overlooked and how they're persecuted without people really understanding them. You know, I mean, it's easy for me as a black birder to take on a black bird kind of as my totem.
You end the piece with a pretty sharp point about how birders should care more about than just counting birds. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. You know, Arun, there are millions of birders doing things from feeding their birds in their backyards to traveling great distances to see birds. And because it's a hobby that depends on us watching a living thing that's also a bellwether of the environment, I think we're tasked with doing more than just watching and tasked with doing more than just listening and thinking about how we conserve these beautiful creatures as fellow beings on the planet who share air and water and earth. I think it's a critical thing that we think beyond our binoculars to think about conserving those other beings that share our space.
Drew Lanham is a professor of wildlife ecology at Clemson University and an avid birder. His piece in Orion magazine called 9 Rules for the Black Bird Watcher is online now. Drew, thank you.
Thank you very much, Arun.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth.
Today, the beauty of Los Angeles is dramatically symbolical of the ancient prophecy that the desert shall bloom like a rose, for this city has become a modern Garden of Eden.
How did that desert bloom into this Garden of Eden, paving the way for Hollywood and Beverly Hills? This 1947 film, produced by Standard Oil of California, now Chevron, explains.
With great courage, men of vision and determination built a gigantic aqueduct system and trapped the white gold melting and tumbling from these lofty peaks.
Thus fulfilling the vision of William Mulholland, LA's chief water engineer. As he stood in front of 40,000 spectators 100 years ago this week, Mulholland gestured toward the water cascade charging down the hillside and declared, "There it is. Take it." That was the birth of the LA Aqueduct. It might as well have been the birth of the modern West. Moving vast quantities of water has made L.A., Las Vegas, Phoenix, and other cities across the region possible. But it's come at a price, and that's our cover story today. How water built the American West, transforming some of the driest places into thriving cities. The $23 million L.A. Aqueduct project took 5,000 workers 5 years to complete. And here's a phrase you may not have heard. It finished on time and under budget.
The state of California would be different. You know, arguably, the world would be different without the LA Aqueduct.
That's John Christensen, the editor of Boom Magazine. Their latest issue looks at the 100-year anniversary of the Los Angeles Aqueduct. While the aqueduct brought water to LA, it took it from somewhere else, Owens Valley.
When the aqueduct was first built, people sold their agricultural lands and their water to the city of L.A. There's lots of claims and evidence that some of that was done secretly without identifying who the real buyers were. And there were a lot of suspicions, but there were also a lot of willing sellers until it really became clear that Los Angeles was intent on taking most of that water. You know, over the years, several big protests, occupying the site of the aqueduct, several bombings of the aqueduct, a lot of anger.
Mention water, politics, and California, and most people think of the 1974 film Chinatown.
See, Mr. Gitz, most people never have to face the fact that at the right time and the right place, they're capable of anything.
You know, that movie is really the great myth of the city and its relationship with Owens Valley and water. Almost nothing about it is historically accurate. But we still often get used in environmental debates and narratives that the big city came and took what it wanted with force and without any regard, you know, for Owens Valley. That troubling history is still very much alive, and it's embodied in this movie.
John Christensen is the editor of Boom Magazine. Chinatown may be fiction, but the centuries worth of mistrust between L.A. and the rural Owens Valley is real. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports that it's one of the West's biggest water wars.
A ride in a helicopter is the best way to grasp the scale and beauty of the Owens Valley along the eastern Sierra Nevada.
We're going to leave our headsets off right now back here, okay?
The valley is sandwiched between some of the highest peaks in North America and the deserts of Death Valley.
We're looking across, probably about 30 miles of length of lake bed. In the background distance is eastern Sierra Nevada mountains, capped off by Mount Whitney.
This is Marty Adams, the L.A. Department of Water and Power's Director of Water Operations.
Well, right under us is basically a flat lake bed that was formerly like salt flats.
That dusty, briny pancake, as big as San Francisco, is now the dry Owens Lake, a direct consequence of 100 years of the L.A. Aqueduct.
Even Teddy Roosevelt, who was the President of the United States, declared that, it was way more valuable to bring that water down to the city of Los Angeles so that the city could grow than it was to let it flow into the salt water of Owens Lake.
The only problem, when the wind blows here, and it does a lot, the dry lake bed can fuel massive dust storms. This area has long carried the dubious distinction of being the largest single source of particulate pollution in the country. And further upstream, the Owens River all but disappeared.
At one time, this valley floor was lush, green, orchards, fields, the agriculture, the farming, we lived off of this land.
Up the road in Lone Pine, you'll meet a lot of folks like Mel Joseph. He grew up in the valley and always heard stories about what it used to be like before L.A. started buying up land, water rights, building dams and channels. A member of the Lone Pine Paiute Shoshone tribe, Joseph says people here are still struggling with asthma and other health issues attributed to the dust. There's no love lost between most people in this valley and the Department of Water and Power.
It's a desert climate, but they made it the dust bowl that it is today.
But the fact is, some things have been done to cool these tensions lately. A few years ago, led by then L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, the city started pumping thousands of gallons of Sierra water back into the Owens River Channel.
By opening these gates today, we'll demonstrate to the world that the great city of Los Angeles is prepared to own up to its history.
Under court order, the city has also spent more than $1 billion so far on dust controls covering more than 90% of Owens Lake. Everyone agrees the air has gotten a lot cleaner, yet many locals rolled their eyes again when the city went back to court this year to argue that its cleanup job here is done. If nothing else, the quibble over that last 10% is a sign that one of the greatest water wars in the West isn't going to end anytime soon.
That's NPR's Kirk Sigler. And as the water leaves the Owens Valley, it comes here to the Los Angeles Aqueduct Filtration Plant.
It's amazing. This whole aqueduct is just an engineering marvel.
Steve Torres is the water utility's superintendent.
We're producing about 420 million gallons today.
And all of that will get distributed to L.A.
The city of L.A. takes about 197 billion gallons a year.
This massive type of hydroengineering changed how we think of cities. Instead of building them where the water is, we build where we want. Dr. Doug Kenny directs the Water Policy Program at the University of Colorado Law School in Boulder.
Back in the 1800s, when John Wesley Powell came out to the West, he basically made the argument that the West shouldn't build large cities and that water was a constraint and people wanted to build large cities. And if that meant we had to enlist the talents of engineers to build pipelines and so on, well, then that's what we're going to do. And there's no denying the fact that without large water conveyance systems, we wouldn't have many of the large cities in the West.
The Western explorer John Wesley Powell would be surprised to see what the West has become today.
If you look at population growth by state, there seems to be this correlation that the drier the state, the faster the population growth. One example I'll give you is Las Vegas, who's dependent almost exclusively on the Colorado River, and they pull their water out of Lake Mead, which is the large reservoir behind Hoover Dam. The trends on the Colorado River are for decreasing flows, and sure enough, the storage level in Lake Mead has been falling in recent years. And the way that creates problems for Las Vegas is that they have their intake, their big pipes that go into the lake that take water out. They're starting to get worried that at least one of their intake is going to be above the water line and so no longer useful.
So what would happen if a city like Las Vegas were to run out of water or to be in a situation where you couldn't meet the needs of the citizens?
You know, it's a really good question just because we don't have anything to point to. You know, it's one of the great success stories of the West, I think, is that you would think that maybe that would happen in an arid region, but it doesn't normally happen. What happens is sometimes water supplies get tight and then cities have to tell people to use less water outside on their landscaping, and that gets them through a short-term problem. And over the long term, they can build more water projects.
So there's been some court challenges recently. The Supreme Court ruled in a case involving a water dispute between Oklahoma and Texas that local state rules actually trumped these agreements between states. There was also a case recently, Florida, I think, has just sued Georgia in a water rights dispute case. What do you make of these?
When I got out of college 20 years ago, the first thing I worked on was this dispute between Florida, Alabama, and Georgia. And it's still going strong. And
it's the same dispute?
It's the same dispute, and it's the nature of these interstate water disputes.
Do you take the Supreme Court decision as a sign that maybe that old way of doing business, I mean, the cliche is Chinatown, right, where a city steals water from a small town and the little guy gets run over. Is it a sign maybe that old way of doing business is gone, or is that, what do you think?
Well, I mean, in any fight, it still pays to be the big guy, but it's not as extreme as it used to be. In California, the LA Aqueduct and the Mono Lake and Owens Valley set of issues there is one that the rest of the country and really the rest of the world really looked to and said, you know, we really shouldn't behave in that way. You know, it shouldn't be that confrontational. And most places, including California, really have done better since then.
Doug Kenny is the director of the Western Water Policy Program at the University of Colorado Law School in Boulder. Doug, thank you.
Certainly.
Mark Gold is associate director of UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. He says LA has made amazing strides in conservation. The city consumes the same amount of water it did in 1970, with 1 million more residents.
If you compare them to other major cities nationally, they're around 123 gallons per capita per day, which is the best in the entire nation. Just continually moving forward with tougher plumbing standards, which are required by state, having tiered pricing on cost. So from the standpoint, if you're a water waster, you're paying a lot more per gallon than if you're actually conserving water well.
Still, Gold says 80% of the water in the state of California is used for agricultural purposes, and he says that needs to be reduced. So the Garden of Eden will be around for a while longer, but it may have fewer lawns and golf courses and more water recycling. This is NPR News. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Arun, always good to be with you, and belated Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Obviously, this is not a new tune, but I have to say I was kind of shocked when I read in Ozzy that this month marks the 30th anniversary of the Thriller video. Makes me feel old.
Absolutely unbelievable. Michael Jackson, the red jacket, the incredible moves, the 14-minute long video. I don't know if you remember that.
Vividly, vividly. So, young kids, go there and watch all 14 minutes of that music video. Learn something.
You know what? Once they start on that, did you see the remembrance that was done for Michael in the Philippines?
Was this the prison group?
Correct. The inmates did the Thriller dance. So for those who want a little something extra, they definitely got to go take a peek at that as well.
And there's also a great Indian knockoff I would recommend.
Many of those who came to enjoy the success of MTV often say that that video was a turning point, not only for music, but for music videos.
Something else you have, it's I think my favorite from this week, these amazing photographs from a man who calls himself an Instagram activist.
Yeah, 43-year-old Ruddy Roy was a writer and journalist in his native Jamaica, born in Montego Bay, but ultimately got frustrated with his fellow photographers who often didn't come up with real enough photographs and pictures. He began taking them himself, and then once he discovered Instagram, he puts together pictures of people who've been marginalized, whether they are poor, whether they are homeless, whether they've face some other kinds of difficulty. And his thought is that so often in life, particularly these days, we're able to gloss over some of the difficulties. And he wants to be what he calls the pothole in our road. He wants to make us stop and face things that are difficult, not going well for others. And he's developed a really incredible following.
They're unbelievable pictures. I mean, they're really haunting. You feel like the eyes are just following you, boring into you.
Well, you know, one of the things that intrigued me about his work and the way he approaches it is he often spends hours learning the backstory. And again, he started his work off as a writer and as a journalist and only later came in to photography from the back end. And now he may lead with photography, at least to our eyes, but also add some beautiful prose to it as well.
Another story this week, I don't really need to do much to set you up, just three words, male belly dancer.
Arun, there is a terrific young fellow named Rashid Alexander who grew up in part in Curacao, down in the Caribbean, as well as in the Netherlands, and at a very young age discovered what some people would call male belly dancing, but which he refers to as Oriental dancing, owing to its longer, almost 6,000-year lineage. He's magical with it, and it's led people all over the world to enjoy his work. Now, Arun, now we've talked a little bit about Dance Day. I guess the big question on the table is, can you dance?
I'm good dancing on the radio, I'll put it that way.
We're gonna leave it to Rashid and Michael. Fair enough.
Thanks, Carlos.
Always good to be with you.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. You can explore all the stories we talked about at npr.org/newandnext. Rob Delaney is a stand-up comic. He's been called the funniest man on Twitter. There's actually an award for that, and he won it. He has a peculiar ability to make clever points about sexism or politics with the gleeful vulgarity of a teenage boy, all in 140 characters. Many of his funniest tweets we can't read on air. His new memoir takes on some pretty serious stuff. Delaney delves into his struggles with alcoholism and depression, but he maintains his irreverent tone throughout and describes how his hard times launched him as a comedian. We began our conversation with the moment just weeks after his 25th birthday when Delaney was at his lowest point.
I'm really lucky in the sense that my bottom really took me to the membrane between life and death, and I got to poke against it and feel its strength and its fragility. I was in a blackout drunk, which was not an infrequent state for me, and I drove into a building, an office of the Department of Water and Power here in L.A. I broke both my arms badly to the point that they needed surgery. And I was in jail in a wheelchair with four limbs that didn't function. So sometimes I would slip out of my wheelchair and to the floor, and my hospital gown would come up, exposing me and all my glory to everybody in jail.
And it's not a good thing, I think.
No.
I'm not an expert in jail.
Yeah, but if you haven't been, that's generally stuff you want to keep to yourself in a jail setting. But I bucked tradition, and it's bad where I got to. Nobody heard about my accident when I had it and thought, get out of here. He drove into a building. They were like, how many casualties were there? You know, so I lived my life in a way where I could have died at any moment, and that was okay with me, which is, yeah, sure, that's sad. But once I realized I could kill other people, that's when I said, okay, I'm going to stop with this because I like other people.
Usually with these sort of biographies, it's the Hollywood type who's writing about this after they've done all this stuff while they were famous.
Yes.
You know, and it was like, oh, you were wasted when you did that album. But with you, it's you kind of got this stuff sorted out, and then you made it big.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate that all this stuff happened and was dealt with, you know, before I started comedy, before I even met my wife. My wife, who I've been married to for 7 years, has never seen me drink, and that's cool. And I'm a dad now. So I'm lucky, and, I was 33 before I made my living only through comedy, and that's like 3.5 years ago. So my appetite for alcohol and drugs probably would have killed me if I had any kind of money or fame. That would have been a very, very volatile combo.
Have you gone over that material before just on a personal level, or was writing through this book the first time that you've gone through things in a really serious way?
Yeah, no, thankfully, I think for the reader, I had really dealt with all that stuff. Writing the book for me was not therapeutic in any way, and I'm glad, because that way you sort of, I think, as the reader, feel safe as you're reading it. You know, you're not like, uh-oh, this is going to devolve into sentence fragments and screaming, and like the next few pages will just be finger-painted blood. And no, you know that I'm talking at it from a position of health, even though I certainly am describing gnarly things.
But at the same time, though, I mean, you don't lose the humor at any point in there. And that's one of the things that was very bracing about reading you talking about it and not losing any of the Rob Delaney-ness.
Well, thanks. You know, depression kills people. It almost killed me. And I'm not saying let's go on a Carnival depression cruise together. I'm saying take a look at this for a few minutes and then look away. And here's ABC how I got out of it.
What was it like changing from Twitter form to going long form?
Well, I started in long form, like the rest of the world. Who knew you could make something as small as a tweet, you know, even 5 years ago? I didn't. You would be forgiven from reading my Twitter feed for thinking that I, you know, was trying to do like Stephen Wright or Mitch Hedberg type stuff with short jokes. Mm-hmm. And I love that stuff, but I don't do it stand-up wise. My stuff is much longer stories.
You know, joke stealing is a big point of controversy, I know, in the comedy world. But you have sort of a relaxed attitude about people stealing your material. Could you explain that?
Well, stealing jokes is wrong. There's no getting around that. But when people do it to me, I just don't stress about it because I would rather go write more jokes. So other people can stress out about that, and they certainly do. If somebody steals a joke of mine online, then 40 people let me know in 10 minutes. So stealing jokes is wrong, but if you do it to me, steal a joke from me, I'd make 5 more and beat you to death with them. That's my approach. You think about it, and I'm going to hurt you with more jokes. That's how I feel.
So we learn a lot about you in the book, but one thing that's not there's not an awful lot about your comedy career and the story of your success.
You're right about that, and I figure that stuff is sort of more public domain. You know, the last few years of my life are very well documented by myself and others in my stand-up as well. So I wanted to show people the plumbing and the framework rather than, like, the coat of paint, which is the last few years.
You can go to Wikipedia for that.
Yeah, and frankly, I would probably write better about the last 3 years, 5 years from now.
Got another book in you?
Yeah, certainly. Might not be about me, though, because currently I'm out of curiosity about myself. It's all been plumbed, those depths. So, yeah, I'd love to write another book, but who knows what it'll be about.
Rob Delaney is one of the funniest people on Twitter. His new book is Mother, Wife, Sister, Human, Warrior, Falcon, Yardstick, Turban, Cabbage. One of the most fun titles to read. Thank you for that, Rob, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And if you're just joining us, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Over the years, American musicians from Stan Getz to Herb Alpert to David Byrne have felt the lure of Brazilian music. World Music DJ Beto Arcos just got back from a trip to Brazil, where he gorged on new music, and he's been kind enough to bring back some to share with us. Beto, welcome back.
I can't tell you how excited I am to share this music with you. It's been one of the most life-enriching trips in my life.
Well, happily you brought some back, and let's start off with this first piece. Is this a samba?
It is a samba by one of the legends of Brazilian music. This is a man who is actually a drummer by trade. I mean, this is what he's done for, you know, most of his life, from the 1950s all the way to the present.
Wow, who's this?
His name is Wilson das Neves. Nem sempre faço aquilo que quero, mas sempre faço tudo que posso. O que eu não faço é o que eu não quero. What you hear in this particular tune and throughout this record is really this wonderful kind of mix of American jazz with samba, because samba is, after all, Brazil's biggest music. Really, this is the people's music. And this last record actually just came out. It's called Se Me Chamar O Sorte, or If You Call Me, Oh How Lucky I Am.
Se me chamar pra sambar eu cisco.
Se me chamar pra tocar balanço.
Se me chamar pra compor capricho.
Se me chamar pra cantar não canso.
Se me chamar.
That's Wilson Das Neves. So who do we have next?
The next singer is a young, up-and-coming artist. Her name is Mayra Freitas, and the song we're going to hear is called Mamembe.
No palco, na praça, num circo, num banco de jardim. Correndo no escuro, pichado no muro, você vai saber de mim. Mamembe, cicano.
It's got a real kind of classic feel to it, right?
It is. She's a really special artist. She's actually the daughter of a great figure of Brazilian popular music. His name is Martinho da Vila. He's both a big pop artist but also a samba singer. Instead of being a samba singer, she decided that she wanted to do her own thing. She was trained as a classical pianist, so you hear the piano very prominent, very present in the record. Mm-hmm. But she also says, you know, I want to try singing. So think of me, she says, as a kind of pianist who sings.
Escravo fugido ou louco varrido, vou fazer meu festival. Mambembe, cicano, debaixo da ponte, cantando.
Said she's young, but she's got a very mature style to her.
She is. She's been surrounded by music all her life, and I got a chance to see her live in concert. And, oh, man, what a soulful presence she is.
So what are concerts like in Brazil?
Concerts are like big parties. You don't sit still. You don't just go and see someone sing and sit there on your chair. You actually dance. You move. You move your body. Brazilian music is all about moving the body, about moving yourself to the music. It's very high energy, very upbeat. And all this music that we're hearing today represents that sound. When you go to a show, you go to sing and you go to dance.
It's hard to sit still with this. Can you tell us the name and song title one more time?
This singer's name is Mayra Freitas, and the song is called Mambembe.
My guest is Beto Arcos, world music DJ. He's fresh from a trip to Brazil where he just loved it. So who do you have for us next?
The next singer is an artist that I was really blown away by. I saw her in a show in the sort of the heart of the clubs of the music in Rio, in an area called Lapa. I saw her and I said, oh my God, where did she come from? She can play, she can dance, and she can sing. Her name is Joyce Cândido.
Pode guardar sua esperança. Não sou mais criança pra te aturar. Se a parada demorou, já é.
So that title means stop it?
Exactly. Se pou parar. It's a way of saying stop it, don't quit messing with me. It's basically a very kind of feminist stance from a woman to a man saying, all right, I've had enough of your messing around. Huh. I'm not going to put up with it anymore. Stop it. She's a really terrific singer. She lived in New York for a couple of years and went back to Brazil. She decided rather than staying here and launching her career here, she decided that she wanted to do it in Brazil. She's originally from São Paulo. She's a terrific presence on stage. She's moving all over the place, and it's really enjoyable, pleasing to see her perform. Her name is Joyce Cândido, and this is a song called Se Pou Parar.
Very nice. Beto, we have time for one more.
One of the legends of Brazilian music. Her name is Alcione. She's actually from the north of Brazil, but she is big. Think of her as a sort of Aretha Franklin of Brazil.
O poeta se deixa levar por essa magia. E o verso bem-vindo e bem-vindo à melodia. E o povo começa a cantar laraiá.
I feel like that voice has a story behind it.
That's right. She came to Rio de Janeiro in the early 70s. She became a superstar. She's one of the most well-known samba artists from Brazil, but really one of the most well-known Brazilian artists, period. In this particular song, she's joined by an up-and-coming voice, the son of a great composer. His name is Diogo Nogueira, and they sing a song all about the power of music, the power of samba, the power of creating music inspired by something that you have no control over.
Não, ninguém faz samba só porque prefere. Força nenhuma no mundo interfere sobre o poder da criação.
That's music by Alcione, brought to us all the way from Brazil by Beto Arcos. He's the host of Global Village at KPFK here in Los Angeles. You can hear all of his picks at nprmusic.org. Sounds like we're only just scratching the surface here.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. There's so much more to Brazilian music. I'm just giving you a little taste of it.
Beto, thanks again and welcome home.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
For the week ending November 3rd, 2013, what's the last thing on this show? Okay, good. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, and Jody Becker. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray. We had engineering support from Leia Delaguila and Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on Saturday and Sunday. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.